Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2012. Lecture 15, delivered on March 20, 2012. The title of this lecture is Time Value of Money.
Today, time value of money. Back in the day, before there were calculators, this was a lot like work. Fortunately, we had tables that would help us with the calculations a lot. And I remember even back, clear back into the, when I was a kid and my parents ran a small loan company. They didn't own it, but they ran it. They had this huge book of these tables of what were called present value factors, present value annuity factors, and they could figure out loan payments and all that with those. And those kinds of tables have been around since the 1700s. As a matter of fact, I recall the copyright on that book of tables that was in that office was 1930s sometime. So the tables have helped, but it's even easier now, and we've got more flexibility, and we can do more things much more quickly with these calculators. And I will tell you this right now. There are a lot of, I've talked about this before, there are a lot of calculators, business calculators, but really the TI 83 Plus and the 84, they can do this stuff just so fast, and it's very simple once you get the routines down. There are a couple of things you always have to keep your eye on, make sure that some of the settings are correct on it, and all of that. But really, these calculators, like the Texas Instruments, even though it's technically a scientific calculator, it serves business functions amazingly well. Now, I'm going to start this off with a random kind of statement here that essentially, when we talk about money, $100, you see, you don't think too much about, well, that's $100, so what? Okay, it's $100 to you. Well, that means a little more. But there's still something in there that I should tell you. Is that $100 I'm going to give you now? Is that $100 I'm going to give you in 10 years? Or $100 in 50 years? Like you're going to live that long? Oh, no, you will. You look healthy. You should eat more vegetables, though. It'll make your bowels clean. But that's the crucial factor. Somewhere in your dark past, you might remember unit conversion, convert feet to meters and inches to centimeters and liters to gallons. Actually, what I'm doing here is unit conversion. It's more complex than the unit conversions of things like length and time and volume and area, because we have to take into account a parameter that changes, interest rates. And those, there's no parameter that changes. It's the same conversion formula every time. With ours, we have this one that changes. So in other words, to change now dollars into dollars 10 years from now, I do a unit conversion. That's all I'm doing in any of these problems. It's just one of those old-fashioned unit conversions. And those tables I told you about in those books, those were nothing but massive tables of unit conversions for different interest rates for different times. You'd have a column for the time, how long the loan was, on the side, and then you'd have a row across for different interest rates, and there you get your unit conversion factor to do it with. Do you remember the unit conversion for inches to centimeters?
2.54.
I wasn't expecting you to. Yeah. What the hell, man? Do you have a life? Yeah, 1 inch equals 2.54 centimeters. Shut my pie hole up there for a second. Yeah, that's exactly right. But with interest rates, you wouldn't be able to do that, you know, with a time value of money, because you'd have to know one for every time in years or months, and for every interest rate, you'd have to know the unit conversion. And all we're doing in this whole thing, and all these calculators do, is the unit conversion. Now dollars to dollars in the future, or future dollars to now dollars, which would be the reciprocal. We also have one more thing that comes into account. Are we talking about a single plop of money, what I call a lump sum of money, or are we talking about a stream of money? Now, if it's a stream of money, we have a name for it. We call it an annuity. An annuity. Now, there are two kinds of annuities. There is an ordinary annuity, and then there is an annuity due. Now, you've got to look at the problem to see which it is. Typically, I'll be talking about an ordinary annuity. If it's an annuity due, there would be something that would flag you. The difference with between these two is that with an ordinary annuity, each of the payments in the stream happens at the end of the period. Each of the payments in the stream happens at the end of the period. That's typically the way it is. Like with a loan payment, you make your payment at the end of each month, or at the end of the month that you started. With an annuity due, the payments begin at the beginning. You would have your first payment happen right away in the stream. Now, on your calculator, where we will be working on this, actually, I should put it this way, you will see down at the bottom a one selection toggle, end, begin. Watch it, make sure it's on the one you want it. Typically, you'll want it on the end toggle. Just keep an eye on that, because I had to give partial credit. Oh, you didn't notice that you had it on the begin button. I know that's what happened here. So when we're talking about annuities, in other words, streams of payment, then what's going to happen is you're going to want to know, well, do the components of the stream happen at the end of each period or at the beginning? And make sure you go down and hit the right toggle choice on that part in the finance facility on the calculator. Now, let me get off ordinary, the annuities for a second, and just talk about lump sums. And the way I do this, I don't... I don't go into a whole lot of theoretical discussion on this, although I can if you want me to. I don't think you want me to. I just say, let's just get this done, because there are actually some very useful things for ordinary people and for you in what I'm going to do here. But the first one is going to be, I got to find someone that I'm going to vex with this issue here. I got to find the right person. I know who I'm going to do this for. Woman, you're going to be old someday. You didn't use oil of Olay properly, so you're not going to be looking really good, you know, kind of, okay, you're going to be a crone. But you want to be rich. When you retire, and you are planning to retire at the age of 70, let's say, you are going to want to have $1 million in the bank. You're going to want that. That way you can buy yourself some nice stuff, pay your rent, and, you know, buy some young cougar bait like this. Once in a while. Okay, maybe not that. But you want $1 million when you retire. Now, you look like you're, what, about 20 or something like that? 20? Okay, now, you'll retire at 70. No, not at that time. They'll make you work until you're 100. But, okay, you want to retire at 70. That's 50 years from now. You would like to know how much you have to put in the bank right now, just as a lump sum, earning interest, compounded monthly. Let's say it's compounded monthly. For you to have $1 million accumulated at the end of that 50 years. And I'm not going to go into details, well, how many months are involved. Let's just say that You are going to put that money into the bank on the first day of January. Well, let's just do it. Let's not even do the dates because that just confuses the basically very simple formula. And I'm going to say the future value, FV, is going to be the present value, the principal value. And then I'm going to take this 1 plus R. Oh, I use R and they use K's anymore. God, I hate K, 1 plus K. And we're going to take that to the nth power. Now, in this formula, future value is, the FV is, the, as I said, the future value. The PV is the present or the principal value. Now, the K, you got to be careful here. This is going to be the periodic interest rate. Periodic interest rate. So I told you that the interest rate was 12% compounded semi-annually. K would be 6% here. You follow that? Semi-annually, you would divide the annual. We always state annual. Unless I say something otherwise, it's always going to be an annual interest rate. But then you have to chop it up into the periodic. So semi-annual is divided by 2. Let's try another one. What a quarterly would be, for monthly, weekly. Oh, please. I had someone come up to me during an exam. How many weeks are in a year? What? But okay. No, seriously. But okay, here's one that's fun. Daily. It's remember, I think I mentioned this. It's 365 as the exponent. It's 360 as the denominator. When you're dividing for the interest rate, it's 360. 360. Now, there's actually the old rule is they did that because 360, there were 5 bank holidays a year. The actual reason was that 360, there's an ancient rule among mathematicians, finance people, traders, that there's a way to divide by 360 that's really easy. Don't ask me what it is. I don't remember what it is, but there was a way. But, okay, so if it's daily, you do a 3, you would divide the annual interest rate by 360. Now, N is the number of total periods. So if it's 50 years and I'm doing this semi-annual, that would be 100 periods. In other words, the number of years times the compoundings per year. Like, for example, with a car loan with monthly payments, you got a 5-year car loan, you'd make 60 payments, 5 times 12. So in the denominator, you are dividing the annual interest rate by the number of periods. Again, in the denominator, for the interest rate, you divide the annual interest rate by the number of periods. For that exponent, you multiply the number of periods times the number of years, the number of compoundings per year times the number of years. You get the hang of it pretty quickly. Okay, so we're going to do, let's just do it something like this. Okay, we would like to know how much you put in the bank now so that you'll have $1 million in 50 years. And let's say that you're earning 12% annual compounded semi-annual. So using this formula, and I can write it backwards, but let's just use it this way. I want a future value of $1 million, and I want that to equal some amount that I'm going to put in now, a principal value, times 1 plus 0.12 over 2 to the 50 times 2. Make sure if you're doing it with this formula that you use decimals for percents. If you're putting it into the calculator's awesome little program, it actually just wants you to put a percent. So there you go. You got to watch on that. If you're going to use a formula, you do things right, the mathematical way, decimals and all that. But the calculator is built so that it wants to see a percent. It assumes that you don't know how to turn a percent into a decimal. So watch it on that. Okay, well, whoops, that's a times, duh. Just testing you there. Okay. Now, if I were to work this out, I'd say, okay, I do, parenthesis, 1 plus 0.12 divided by 2, close the parentheses, raise that to the 100th power, and I get an annuity factor, $1 million equals PV times this 339.3021. And this, in these calculations, go at least 4 decimals out if you're going to do intermediate steps. Really, you should probably go even further than that. But interestingly, the old style tables I was telling you about in those books, I remember almost all of them had four decimal places, all of those factors. That's one of those factors that I was telling you about in the book. They looked like that. Some of them were big numbers, some of them were decimal numbers. But anyway, I can say that, okay, $1 million divided by that 339.3021 is going to be the principal value I need to put in. So if I were to do that, $2,947.23. Is that right? Look at that. You can be a millionaire in 50 years by just putting in $2,947.23. Is that awesome or what? Now, of course, in 50 years, that $1 million would probably buy you a loaf of bread and maybe some ramen noodles. But at the same time, that gives you an idea of the very beginning of what we call estate planning. When people say, well, I want to have this amount of money at this point in the future. We can say, well, you could just put that in, leave it alone in a long, long-term CD, and you'd be there. Or we could do it another way where you put in a certain amount every month as an annuity. And we'll get to that in a minute. But really, what I'm showing you right here is the beginning of the whole idea of that's behind planning for retirement, planning for an estate, and all of that kind of stuff. We can ask questions about, okay, I want in 5 years to have enough money to put a down payment of $20,000 or $40,000 on a house. What would I have to do right now? I got some money that's coming in. How much would I have to put in the bank at a certain interest rate to be able to have that in 5 years? We can do that with this kind of a formula. Now, I want to give you the two formulas straight up here. Again, these are the lump sum formulas. The one is for future value. If we wanted to just find a future value straight up, 1 plus k to the n. The other way to do it, which I should have done in that problem, is a present value is the future amount times 1 plus k to the negative nth power. That's the same as saying future value over 1 plus k to the positive nth power. I usually just use the negative exponent instead of dividing. Watch out for your parentheses when you do these, though. If you're going to do it straight by the straight just mathematical calculation, and also again, don't forget that right there. Okay. Now, I mean, you can do a lot of different problems with these, and they're kind of useful if you're just talking about a lump sum, put money in, how much comes out at the end. Or if I want a certain amount at the end, how much do I put in? So future value and present value of lump sums, just straight up, you can just run them on the calculator real fast. The one that is a little bit more complex, the formula is actually a little bit like, whoa, but on the calculator, it's just a joke. And we're going to go to the calculator very quickly on these. The annuities. Now, I usually work with, just to show the examples, with ordinary annuities. But, I mean, the calculator will do the annuity due as well. Let's try one just off the top of your head. I'm trying to look at someone. Have you ever gotten lucky? No, I don't imagine. Well, yes, you have. You're looking at me like, what the hell? No, I mean, like a lottery ticket or something like that. Okay, well, most people don't. But this time, you did. Okay, now, the way this lottery works is they're going to say, all right, you have won a big pile of money. We are going to give you $5,000 every month for 5 years. Now, they say that, but they can also say, or you could take a plop of money right now instead, if you wanted to. And you'd have to say, all right, well, how much would I have to get to be indifferent between the stream of the annuity and the lump sum now? Because that stream does have a collapsed value now. And we can figure that out. And we're going to do it on a calculator. I'm going to write down the problem first. This will be the present value of an ordinary annuity. You could receive $5,000 a month, and let's say for 10 years, or you could take a lump sum settlement now. If the risk-adjusted interest rate appropriate to this cash flow is 8%, how much would you take now instead of the annuity? And we're going to crank this out on your calculator, and I'm going to assume that you have a TI 83 or an 84, a plus or an 84. Now, clearly, the first thing you want to identify, and in any word problem, get the words out of it as fast as possible. You want to know a now. You don't know a now. So the thing that will be blank that you'll ask the calculator to tell you is a present value. That's what you don't know is the now. Because I'm asking, how much now? So you pull your calculator out, and let's try turning it on first. I was wondering why it was blank. Okay, I thought my contact lenses were a little fuzzy. Okay, okay, now, you hit the apps button, APPS, and then the one is finance, or finance if you come from south. Now you see that TVM solver that you come to, the first one? You choose that little mother, or that thing. Now, we're going to go through the grinder. Don't do calculations the calculator will do for you. Because if you're like me, you suck at arithmetic. We're in the 21st century. We can't think for ourselves. See the N? We have 10 years, and it's going to come every month. So on that end line, just hit 10 times 12. And then just go down or hit enter. You should have seen a 120. You saw that, right? I swear, tell me you saw that. Okay, good, good. Okay, now, see the I? Just key in an 8, not 0.08 for God's sake, an 8, and divide it by 12. That'll be your monthly interest rate as a percentage. And then just hit enter or just down arrow. You should have seen a 0.6666 and all that, okay? Now, see the PV? Leave it alone. If there's a number there, who cares? Just leave it alone. Now, you go down to your payments. You know what your payment's going to be. You're going to get $5,000. Now, the future value. There was no balloon at the end. That would be if there was some kind of a big bonus at the end or some kind of a balloon at the end, payment of some kind. In a case like this, there's nothing, so put a zero there. Now, you see that P over Y and that C over Y? Make sure they are one. If they are not one, then you're going to get the electronic calculator equivalent of a wedgie. Don't make the calculator give you a wedgie. You'll see in the textbook, oh, put a 12 in there. Don't, for God's sake. Now, do you see down at the bottom where it says PMT end and begin? That's where you get the ordinary or the annuity due. Okay? Now, since we're going to get these at the end of every month, at least by assumption, if it doesn't say anything differently, you're not going to get your first payment instantly. It's going to be at the end. So we'll put it on end if it's not already there. Now, go up to the PV and hit second answer. My ass, I'm sorry. I can't see, it's not the answer. What is that? Green saw. My ass, really? Oh yeah, that is right. Now, you see that negative sign on it? PVs, present values, always put them in negative. If you have to put in a present value, or if it calculates, it'll come out negative. It's just a quirk with calculators, and I've seen this ever since they started having financial calculators. That negative sign is just part of the way it works. They've got explanations of it that sound kind of reasonable. It's just a quirk of calculators. The truth of the matter is that the answer is that you would take, right now, instead of the annuity, at that interest rate of 8% compounded monthly, you would take $412,107.40 right now instead of that annuity stream. Now, if you think about it, 10 years, you got $5,000 a month for 12 months. That would be $60,000. For 10 years, that'd be $600,000. You're not, and the present value is less than that. Well, that's obviously going to make sense because you're going to have it all now so you could invest it yourself through that period. A present value of an annuity should come out to be less than just a straight arithmetic calculation of the cash flow stream because you have what's called discounting happening of the cash flow. The money that is coming later and later is worth less and less to you now. So this number actually does make sense. And that's always a good little reality check. If the number that comes out of the calculator is some massive number larger than the cash flow stream itself, you know you've gotten something wrong. If it's a tiny number, you know you've done something wrong. This number looks about right. The discount is about what? A third to take it all now? That doesn't mean it's worth less if you take it all now because now you have the money and you could invest it yourself or enjoy it now. instead of over a period of the next 10 years. But that right there is the present value of that annuity. And that was an ordinary annuity. Let's try another one here. Let's see if you can catch all the nuances. You plan to start saving money. Some money. At the beginning of every quarter, you will put $250 into a savings account that pays 7.8% annually. You will do this for the next 20 years. How much will be in the account when you withdraw the money at the end of 20 years, those 20 years? When you withdraw the money at the end of 20 years. Okay. Don't let any of the words fool you in here. A couple of things that you're going to want to do, and like I probably mentioned this, for years I taught math, and one of the things about math is word problems always upset people, or at least most people. Just get the damn numbers out of them and get any other relevant information, then walk away from the words. First of all, look at this word beginning right there. What is that telling you? Talk to me. Yeah, this is an annuity due. So on that calculator, you go down and pop that begin button. You might even want, I actually do that first just to make sure that I don't forget to go over and pop that begin button, because this will be an annuity due because everything is happening at the beginning. Now, I'm going to go up here. Let's start working our way down through the numbers. Okay, I got a $250. Where does that $250 go? Payment, yeah. $250. If I key in $250. Okay, now let's go up to the N. How many years are there? How many years were there? Oh, yeah, 20. So I do 20 times what? 20 times 4, because I'm going to do this 4 times every year. Go down to the I percent. Here you just put in 7.6 divided by 4. Don't do it separately. Just let the calculator do it for you. This is actually really easy once you know that the calculator is going to do most of the legwork for you. Now, drop it down. You don't have any lump sum at the... there's no present value. We want to know what's at the end. There's no kicker at the beginning, so you put a zero in for the present value. Now walk your way down to the FV, because we want to know what's going to happen 20 years from now. Okay, so here we go. Just hit the green button, or whatever it is, alpha, solve. you'll have $47,028.05. Make sure you got that. If you didn't, for God's sake, talk. Because it might be that I got it wrong. I think that's right, though. 47,000, is that what you got? Wait, what? Did I do 7.6 divided by 4? Oh, 7.8. I was just testing you to see. That's what can happen is that. Shit. Well, that changed it. Oh. Yeah, I did a little bit. $48,202, yeah. Thank you. $48,202.75. Is that right? Yeah. Okay, that is just simply said, okay, you put it in at the beginning of every quarter, then you stop, and at the end of the last quarter, you pull it out, there's how much you got. That's it. That's all there is to the problem. Couple of practical things. Let's try a couple of something practical. Your dream car is, what would be a dream car? What, a Kia Stupide? I don't know. What are those, huh? Well, yeah, but I mean, I want a babe machine. You don't, obviously. Okay, good. You want a practical car that gets good mileage, yet is stylish and elegant and says, I'm ready for the 21st century. Look out, world. And also look out, children, even if you're in the crosswalk, because I will run you over. So we're going to get you something that is nice. We're going to get you a car that costs, let's say, $18,500. You're going to get it all on a loan, a 5-year, let's say, oh, let's put it at an 8.69%. APR, monthly payments. You can find out what the payments are. And I'll tell you right now that if you figure out what the payments are, you'll know whether your loan company is going to approve it, because if you know what their percent of income is, you'll know whether it's probably going to go through based on your credit rating. Go up to the top, N. 5 times 12, because these car loans are always going to be monthly, so it's going to be 5 times 12. Go down to I percent, 8.69 divided by 12. Your present value. You want to borrow right now, AD, excuse me. God, that was actually kind of tasty. You know, I'm going to just shut up because I can't even get my Denny's to stay down. Grand Slam was better first. Negative $18,500. Remember, PVs, always put them in negative. Don't ask me why. Now, the future value, you're going to have no kicker payment at the end. There's no balloon at the end. You're just going to pay your payments, amortize them down until it's over. So you put a zero. Now, normally, they're not going to make you pay your first payment right away. If they do, go to another bank. Go down to the bottom and say, I'm going to make my first payment at the end of the first month. So you toggle to end. Normally do that, unless I say something about it being like happening right away. Just normally, you would want the end. Now go back up to payment. Let's see what my payment is. Solve. There's your payment right there. You can find out what your payment is. And that is actually surprisingly useful. I can't remember when the study was done. It's been more than a few years ago. I think it was in like 2006. An audit was done of payments on normal car loans by three banks. And they found that a little over 40% of the car payments, the payments that were calculated for loans of consumers, and they audited something like 40,000 accounts, were wrong. Anywhere from a couple of cents up to, in a couple of cases, $12, $13. They were just wrong. It doesn't hurt you to be able to do this so that you know walking in that what the payment is going to be. And if it's different, say, show me how it's different from what I calculated. They might have a good reason, or they might just say, well, that's our computer. If they do say that, then that's not right. But you would be surprised, even to this day, if they just, the computers don't get it right sometimes. And so it doesn't hurt for you to be able to do your own calculation, and also just for your own purposes, all right, what can I afford? See, okay, what kind of payment would this car put me under for 5 years, for 6 years, for 4 years? You can just do them right on your calculator that fast. Okay. You graduated from this awesome institution and you want to live the dream. You want to buy a house. And so what you're going to do is you're going to say, I want to live in Decatur because I'm a Decatur kind of guy. So much culture comes from Decatur. Much of the great country music of my time, Truck Stop Parking Lot Angel. I was standing in the window looking through the pane. The kids are ugly because of you. I put my heart on eBay and you didn't bid. So you want to go back down to your roots and buy a house. You find a nice house. $175,000. You want to get a loan for $175,000 on a 30-year FRM, fixed rate mortgage, at 5.75% APR. Can you make the loan? Normally, well, the rules vary. But one thing that you can do right off the bat is do your first pass at an affordability check. They'll say, how much do you make a month? Your payment can't be more than 25% of what you make take home every month, or 33% of what you take home every month. You'll find out if you can live the dream in Decatur. Okay? You just key it in. It's a 5.75% APR fixed rate mortgage. You're going to make payments every month, so you can just go right up to the top. 30 times 12. Take it down to the next one. You got a 5.75% APR annual percentage rate. Divide that by 12. Take it down. You're going to borrow $175,000. Put in negative $175,000. There's no payment at the end, no future balloon on it. The payments are at the end of every period. Make sure you got it on the end. Take it up to your payment and get alpha solve. $1,021.25 is what your payments would be every month on that house. You can figure out your own loan, your own affordability. You would probably say in a case like that, well, I probably have to be pulling down about $4,000 a month for a bank to qualify this. That would be their first pass, is something like that. They'd also do some credit checks and all that kind of stuff, make sure you're not ugly and things like that. But at the same time, this would be your first pass. Okay, can I afford this payment? I think I can. The bank is going to use an affordability index of 25%. I make $4,000 a month, $48,000 a year, take home. Yeah, they'll probably pass me on this. And like I said, there'll be other hurdles. But you can do this yourself with this calculator routine. I'm going to show you one last thing here. Tell you a little history. But now you can do annuities. You can do lump sums. You can do the whole nine yards. That's all there really is to the whole story. Now, the problem, of course, is that what I've done here were level annuities. Level means that the cash flow was the same every month through or every time it happened. So that can change when we do actual analysis of projects. We have the cash flow is different in different years, so we have to just telescope them back one at a time as lump sums or do some other trick. But it's all basically the same thing. In business, we want to know, most of the time, we want to know what's going to happen right now. So when someone says, this project is going to start bringing in money next year, we're going to spend $50,000 on it now, then it'll bring in $10,000 a year from now, $20,000 next year, $25,000 a year after that, et cetera, we can actually telescope all those positive cash flows back to the present and compare that to what it's going to cost now. That's how we do project analysis. That's really all there is to it. Small companies have a different thinking way. They use like an options pricing thing, but realistically, if you ever did finance in the real world, or if you face financial bean counters, this is what they do. They just calculate the present values of the future expected cash flows and compare them to the cost of the project. That's what this is all about. Now, I'm going to take a little bit of a history thing here. Whenever you get one of these annual interest rates, there's something going on under the surface with compounding. This goes back to actually a long, long time ago. And I had mentioned this before, I'm pretty sure. The financial industry back in the 1800s was just a mess in the United States. Charlatans, crooks, liars, thieves, fools, cat stranglers, dog beaters. I mean, it was just a host of really, really unsavory characters and some ethical people as well, trying to run banks and do financing and all of that kind of stuff. It was just a catastrophe. And it led to repeated bank failures in the later 1800s. And finally, the United States government got kind of sick of it. And they did a couple of reforms. They tried to pass some legislation. But really, the politicians were so much in the pockets of these big, powerful business interests, that there wasn't any real hope for a lot of reform. But then there was a period of more anti-business, pro-labor, in the second decade of the 20th century, where they tried to put some reforms in place. They put the Federal Reserve in to try to oversee banks. Didn't really work really very well. And by the time you got to the 1920s, it was just wild and crazy. Bankers, these very powerful, rich families, were gaming the system. They were creating rumors to destroy other banks, and then they were acquiring them. Pyramid schemes were all over the place. You can earn 18%, 20%, 100% interest in our bank. I mean, that was just normal. And people were stupid enough to buy into this kind of stuff. And of course, they got their asses kicked pretty easily. A lot of people lost a lot of money in that time with these fraudulent schemes banks and quote-unquote banks and investment houses were doing. When we get to 1932, and if I have the chance, I'll give you a broader lecture that will include the politics and the social situation of the time. But for now, when we get to the 1932 election, that by that time, the American people had essentially said, enough of this crap. We have had a crash of the stock market. People have lost savings in banks. Pension funds have been wiped out. People are living on the streets. It's miserable. Unemployment is ridiculous, stupidly high. And we've got to have someone in the presidency who is going to lay down the law and bring about an era where the government doesn't just sit back and say businesses can self-regulate, which was the whole thing of the 1920s. And before that, it was going to have to be a president who essentially took the business community, the financial community, by the hair and dragged it into an era of behaving itself. And if it couldn't behave itself, it would be whipped like a bad, bad child. Franklin Delano Roosevelt and a whole pile of Democrats were voted into office in the elections in November of 1932. And he had no mercy on these rich people. He said very quickly, "The rich despise me, and I welcome it. Bring it on." And there you had this whole series of regulatory agencies laid out. The Securities and Exchange Commission, no more of this crap with these fraudulent stock sales and these phony companies and ripping people off. And there was also a mass of banking reform, too. And there were reforms in other sectors as well. But in the banking sector, you had the origins of what was called the Glass-Steagall Act. It was just essentially a whole system of regulation of banks, cracking down on them. No more of your fraud. No more of your promises of the moon. No more of your hidden bank statements. No more of your interlocking directorships. No more of these massive banks. When they fail, they could bring down the entire economy. No more of that crap. Well, wait. Isn't that kind of what happened in the Yes, it is, because Glass-Steagall was repealed in 1999. It wasn't even the Bush administration. It was the neoliberals of the Clinton administration. I'm of a mixed opinion about the strength of the economy was awesome in the 1990s. Like, you guys have labored, and you will labor under a much, much more difficult economy than we had in the 1990s. Under the Clinton administration and the divided Republican control of the legislature. It was a great era. Stable taxes and a lot of incredible innovation, but they were also in the pockets of big business. Realistically, the banks were screaming, "We can self-regulate. Look at us. We're responsible. We wear suits to work. We can write these cool things called derivatives, and it will make the whole world economy move more efficiently. Capital will flow better. Risk will be moved to those who can bear risk and away from those who don't have to bear it." Well, get rid of this Glass-Steagall Act. My God, it did. And guess what happened? You live in a diminished era because of it. You're going into a job market that is just barely starting to come back to its own, because of the disasters of letting the banks self-regulate, which they are still doing, because no one is going to challenge the banks and try to bring back Glass-Steagall. But in its day, Glass-Steagall laid out walls, banks you can't do this, banks you must do that. One of the things that they did was they laid down essentially an interest rate that was the maximum interest rate that a bank could provide or promise to a passbook savings account holder. It was 5.25%. No bank was allowed to offer or provide any interest higher than that for a passbook savings account. This was just simply stop offering people these ludicrous interest rates. People are stupid. They'll go for it. You'll create a pyramid scheme, and then you won't be able to provide those interest rates. So that was a sort of like a law of the land, this 5.25% interest rate. Now, speaking from the economic side, that would be what we call an effective, that would be called a price ceiling. essentially the market might want to go to a higher level, but this put a ceiling on where the market could go. Now, obviously, and you've seen this, supply and demand dynamics might put actual interest rates above that, but the banks were locked here. Now, for decades, 5.25% was actually well above what banks needed to provide. The supply and demand conditions were such that realistically 3%, 2%, something like that was fine. But eventually interest rate pressures really did start bumping up so that banks were facing this difficulty that they really did need to pay more than 5.25% to attract funds because there were other investment vehicles that were very safe that people could put their money into and get better than 5.25%. So the banks were kind of like, okay, what do we do? Should we go back and ask them to repeal this part of Glass-Steagall? That wasn't going to happen. Even in the most pro-business era, back in the late World War II and into the 1950s, when the Republicans came back with a vengeance, there were very few voices who were going to say Glass-Steagall needs to go. No one was quite that naive. So this 5.25% price ceiling was still there, even though supply and demand conditions in the money markets might have put it at, let's say, 5.5%. This effective price ceiling at 5.25% created a shortage. The quantity being demanded and the quantity being supplied were not in equilibrium. Okay, so how did the banks deal with this? They came up with a trick. It was an old trick. Everyone knew the trick, but it became very popular. They started compounding the interest rate. Technically, the law says 5.25%, but it doesn't say we can't compound more than once a year. Well, here's the way you calculate an effective interest rate. Let's say, what is the effective interest rate on 5.25% compounded semi-annually . Watch and here's the formula . Here's how you do it . All you do is you take 1 plus 0.0525, the APR, but you divide it by 2 and then you raise it to the second power. Just do that. Divide it by the number of compoundings and raise it to the number of compoundings. And then you subtract 1 from it. I'm sorry. Okay, so, and be sure you do the subtracting by 1. Okay, so you go 1 plus, parenthesis, well, let's do it all in one stroke. Parenthesis 1 plus 0.0525 divided by 2, close the parentheses and raise that to the second power, and then subtract 1. And you'll come up with 5.32%. Oh, look at that. The effective annual rate has gone above the ceiling. It was perfectly legal to do it, and banks started doing it. Oh, we can offer more than the statutory rate, but stay within the statute. Let's try it with quarterly. Do 1 plus 0.0525 over 4 to the fourth power minus 1. Parenthesis 1 plus 0.0525 divided by 4, close parenthesis, raise that to the fourth power, subtract 1, and you get 5.35%. Every time you make the number of compoundings more per year, you're nudging up the effective annual rate. You can take this up. Actually, I don't think any of you will ever see it. I certainly won't. You could technically take compoundings to the infinite. There's actually a formula to do it for an infinite number of compoundings per year. But that's not going to happen in your lifetimes. Look at 1 for daily. 1 plus 0.0525 divided by 360 to the 365th power minus 1. Parenthesis, 1 plus 0.0525 divided by 360, close parenthesis, to the 365th power minus 1, you get 5.47%. You can, if you want to go to compounding daily, you can bring it up to almost 5.5%, which was enough room for banks, and that's why compounding got into such fashion, was to nudge it above, nudge a passbook savings account rate above the actual. And it's done with other accounts too. That's all I have for you. I thank you.